Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 147th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is a somewhat unconventional choice because she's an American-born woman from New York City. But you will soon see why she's a great fit for this show, a New Mainer a couple of generations removed. Judith Sloan is a performer, writer, oral historian, audio and radio artist, educator, and engaged citizen. Her Jewish family, originally from Belarus and Ukraine, experienced firsthand many of the obstacles today's immigrants face. And she has built a professional career around eliciting and telling these kinds of human migration stories to all kinds of audiences. She and her husband have been spending summers in Stonington, Maine for 25 years, and this summer she'll be offering several shows around the state. Judith, it is such a pleasure to have you on the phone today. Thank you, and welcome to New Mainers Speak.
Thank you so much.
You are my very first guest from Stonington, Maine, and Hancock County. You've been retreating to Maine in the summers for many years, all the way back from your childhood. Can you tell us what brought you here originally and why you keep coming back?
Well, I haven't really been there since childhood. We went there once, I think, on a vacation with my dad, who was kind of hilarious, and my one memory was running out of gas and him telling us all to, you know, kind of egg the car on in the seats, and he turned the ignition off rolling down a hill. So that's a very strange childhood memory of Maine. But I started coming in my 20s when I was working on some solo work and had been in a theater company, and then started on an experiment going up and taking a clown workshop. And that may seem like a very strange juxtaposition of, you know, disciplines, but yeah. I started creating characters. And I continued going up to Maine, actually to Sedgwick, which is a small town right before you get to Stonington, because some friends of mine had moved up there. And then over the years kept doing shows and meeting people, and over the years have done a lot of benefits for local organizations, sometimes in the winter, sometimes in the fall, and definitely in the summers, because my husband teaches full-time at SUNY Purchase, and he has this time off to write.
That's beautiful.
So that's like, why we've been coming back.
Sounds like your dad's not the only funny one in the family.
We'll see.
Can you tell us?
Time will tell.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you tell us a little bit about your family's immigration experience and how that might have prepared you to have such a keen awareness for the concerns of today's immigrants?
Well, my grandmother lived with us for a short period of time, but I had one grandmother, one grandparent. The rest of them died before I was born. And she had a very thick accent. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, where most of the old people, if you did have grandparents, they were either Jewish or Italian or Puerto Rican. So all of the old people had accents. And I remember as a little girl thinking that part of the aging process is that you get older, you get wrinkles, and you develop an accent. I thought, oh, when I get old, I'm going to have an accent. So when I was in my 20s, I started channeling a character that talks like this, that was telling stories about living here in the United States, losing my husband, whose family all died in the Holocaust. And I'm telling you something, it's very nice to be on the radio with you because I have something to tell you, Kate, which is that if we talk long enough, the whole world, we're going to find out they're related. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Nice.
So I started doing this character and over time started interviewing Holocaust survivors and got involved in several kind of grant projects of taking oral histories from older European Jews and Holocaust survivors and embedding them in a very long script, and then traveled with that material for a while. As far as my family goes, I think for people who are visual artists, they might have this experience where they paint a painting or they do something that they put out creatively, and then it makes them look back at their real life. And in a way, that character was like painting a memory that I wasn't really conscious of. So during my 20s, I started digging around and trying to find out where my family was from and who was who and why did they change their name. And it took a long time to figure all this stuff out because my grandmother died when I was 9 and my father died when I was 12. And there was a lot of secrecy around those deaths. But I did find out that my grandmother had 7 brothers and sisters who all got killed in the Holocaust, and that my dad had looked for them after the war and didn't find anybody. But it was like having a legacy of a whole family tree disappear in real time, not just living someone else's history. So as an American-born person, I was very much... I had my own emotional angst and hauntedness about loss being ripped apart from my family. And so I don't know if the characters and the performances were also a way of repairing some of that, or trying to repair, or trying to recreate and find a new family. But I did that, and I toured for a while and then moved to New York and started working on other projects. And I live in Queens, and it's the most diverse place in the United States. And people here wear that as a badge of honor a lot. There's something like 175 languages spoken here. Wow. It keeps going up. You know, 10 years ago, it was 138 languages. And so we did this big project called Crossing the Boulevard, and I feel like my understanding of loss and having to rebuild your life from scratch is what helped me in interviews with over 150 new immigrants and refugees who had fled everything from wars to economic disasters to earthquakes or, you know, some other, all the reasons why people flee their home and come here.
Yeah, you've taken
so
your...
we wrote a big book and did a lot of performances on that as well.
It's exciting work. And you've taken your deep personal losses and the devastating family losses from the Holocaust, and you've transformed that in yourself, and now you're sharing that transformation with other people. It's quite beautiful.
I hope so. I mean, you know, I think all artists are just trying to do... I mean, at some point, also, you look at the world and my current situation, and I think, okay, what are we living with, and how did it get to be... There's a tremendous amount of hateful rhetoric. And if we're going to look back at our own histories or at history that's not our own, what's the point if we're not going to try and apply it to our current world?
Right. How can we learn from this?
Well, I don't want to just stay stuck in an archive. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
She's stuck in an archive.
But you're not stuck in an archive, because you and your husband, Warren Lehrer, founded an organization in 1999 called Earsay, whose mission is dedicated to uncovering and portraying stories of the uncelebrated. Tell us more about Earsay. How do you go about fostering understanding across cultures and generations and gender and class with projects like Crossing the Boulevard?
Well, the first project we did was Crossing the Boulevard. That was... like massively large.
And that was a book
and
in the end?
It's a book. It's if people visit our website, earsay.org, they can snoop around. It's a book. It's a exhibition. It's a multimedia project. It's, you know, a series of public radio documentaries that aired on public radio. And it's a performance. And now I'm actually doing it on Monday. Although I guess by the time this airs, it would have been Monday the 17th. I'm doing it in New York with a multi-ethnic, multiracial cast. And it, you know, when we were interviewing people, we weren't, the criteria wasn't, did you come from a wealthy background? Did you come from an educated background? Or did you come here with absolutely no means of support? So we interviewed the range of people who came fleeing war, fleeing, you know, maybe a military dictatorship or totalitarian regime. And some people did come with systems of support, and some people came with nothing. And I think you're seeing that in Maine a lot, right?
Yes,
like
we are.
For the first time in the last 20 years. Maine, when I first started coming to Maine, you didn't see sort of recent immigrants, and certainly not recent immigrants of other colors. And I think the difference in our country, in the United States, is when that 1965 immigration law changed and opened up the doors to more and more people from southern and eastern hemispheres, the racial and ethnic demographic of the United States changed. So before it was mostly white Western Europeans. And I think it's part of what's happened is people have not figured out how to deal with that. I mean, I'm talking about globally, not specifically in certain areas. You know, in certain cities, people have had time to find the joy and the expansion of your own way of looking at the world by being with people from so many different countries.
Yeah, I love that
I
you said that.
I think that's happening in Portland, right?
It is happening in Portland. Yep. There's a rich appreciation for the culture that's being added to the culture that exists here already.
And it's also necessary. I mean, in certain towns, there was just a report about Utica, New York, that it was just falling apart and empty. And it took new immigrants and refugees to rebuild that town.
Breathe some life back into it.
Yeah, and also, yeah. You know, the same kind of thing has happened in Queens 20 years ago. There were neighborhoods that were falling apart and nobody wanted to be there. You know, and people that had nothing came and rebuilt those places. And now, of course, everything's gotten more expensive. So you've got this cycle, right?
Yes.
Building something up, and then some people get pushed out. And in that cycle, I guess for us as artists, and you asked that question, how do we sort of build bridges across cultures, is this idea that if you can tell the story and you can hear somebody's history, hopefully you can see them as human and figure out a better way of coexisting.
I love that approach. If you're just joining us, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak. My guest today is Judith Sloan. She's a poet, actor, artist, and human rights activist. And for over 20 years, she's been producing and presenting works in audio and theater, portraying voices often ignored by the mass media. Community radio in general and New Mainers Speak have much the same mission, so it is a special pleasure to have this chance to visit with you today, Judith. I wanted to say that NPR's Public Radio International says that you do oral history with a twist, and you're bringing some of your insights to the stage in Maine this summer. Can you tell us a little bit about your oral history passion and where that came from?
I wish I could tell you, like, a really simple answer. I'm curious. And, you know, if you run into somebody and they start telling you a story, you know, you're at the laundromat and they're telling you a story about why they left Egypt while you're on the rinse cycle, it changes your daily, you know, experience of being with that person. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, it does.
And I also think there are things that we, as human beings, we can recognize in each other, even through, like, really gigantic differences. So I'll give you an example. I wasn't planning on interviewing people about what it felt like to live under military dictatorships or totalitarian regimes, but it's something that I did do over time. And I had started out interviewing Holocaust survivors, so that extreme experience of being forced into ghettos and, you know, laws changing and what it took to then annihilate so many people, it didn't happen overnight. So I guess about, what was it, maybe 15 years ago, I was interviewing this woman from the Philippines, and she was talking about having been detained and also just her entire life story of growing up in the Philippines, living under the military dictatorship of Marcos, and then coming, getting a fellowship to the Iowa Writers Conference and Iowa Writers Program, actually, at the University in Iowa. And that she, at one point I said, well, what did it feel like? And, you know, her answer was, she said, it was suffocating. Marcos was everywhere. He hired people to write books. He hired people to write books in his name. His children were everywhere. They were on TV. And, you know, when I was listening to her, and besides the kind of restrictive world of living, you know, she was under house arrest for a while, just talking about the cultural way that it was suffocating. She said it took up every conversation. And I feel that way now, you know, that the suffocating element of the politics of what's going on right now.
Yeah, you're seeing the similarities. The things you didn't expect to find in life.
And right. Yeah. Well, but that's, you know, I mean, I guess people that talk a lot about improvising, you know, you improvise because you may be going down a certain path and something happens that forces you to change,
mm-hmm.
right? And, okay, now I'm going to shift and I'm going to think about how am I going to respond to the news or how am I going to respond to what's going on? And can I put it, for me, at this point, it comes into that combination of listening, sometimes making up fictional characters and also doing work that's based on oral histories.
Yeah, you're a real...
So I'm actually experimenting with fictional characters now as well.
Well, they can incorporate several people's stories in a powerful way, can't they?
Yeah, and also if I hear something, I can sift it. If I have a character that's already talking about some issue or some part of their life, if I hear something in the news, I can embed it in that character. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It makes great sense. It's a real art form. And you've woven people's stories into an Eve Ensler-like performance format. And you do that as a one-woman show. Is that right?
That's what I'm doing. That's part of what I'm doing, yeah. I'm also writing other things for other people. But what I'm going to be doing in Maine is a series of different characters and monologues. And it allows me to embed things. So should I give you an example of something that already existed and then had the character respond to the news?
Sure, I'd love to do that.
So, for example, I have a hairdresser character, and that is based somewhat on just my knowledge of hairdressing because I was a hairdresser for a while. When I was 18, I went to hairdressing school because I knew I needed to get a job that would be able to support myself because I was pretty much on my own. And I have this character that talks about her customers and about hair and also about, you know, image. So I'll just do a little bit of her, okay?
That would be great.
I have this customer, Helen, And I'm telling you something. She said to me, if you got a dream, you got an idea, don't just go back to bed. You got to get up, make it tangible, write it down, make it tangible. Well, Helen, you're not going to believe this, but she had her very first art show. I mean, she's a painter, and she's been painting for a long time, and she had a very first art show when she was 60 years old. And she titled her show, The Memory I Forgot. I told her, get out of here. What kind of a name is that? The Memory I Forgot. If you forgot it, why would you call your memory? But she said that she had painted a painting, and it reminded her of something that had happened to her years ago. I think you've heard about that kind of theme, right? See, Helen, she wasn't able to talk about certain things for a very long time, and I had to think about that. You know, I was watching the news, and I was listening to these women who had all been sexually harassed on the Bill O'Reilly show. I don't know. Did you follow that, Kate? Did you see that story?
Oh, yeah.
And here are all these women saying that they didn't say anything for a really long time. And some people said, well, why didn't they say anything right away? And this one woman said she was like a deer caught in the headlights. She didn't know what to say. She didn't even know how bad it was till she went home afterwards. And then later she would think about something to say. And you know something, Kate? I'm like that. Somebody says something really insulting to me, and I cannot think of what to say. Sometimes I don't even realize what it is until 6 months later, and then I'm so angry I blow up. Some people have a talent to say the right thing at the right time. I am so impressed by some people. For example, I was on the subway the other day, and there was a woman, it was a very, very crowded subway, and there was a woman who held up a hand over her head, and she shouted, excuse me, did somebody lose this hand? I found it on my ass. And so I think, like, you know, it's a way of using that character as a way of incorporating things that are happening right now and giving voice to things that the character had already been saying, because later she tells more of the whole story of her customer, Helen, and what kind of painting she had painted and her art show and what that meant for her. And here's something that I think some people could probably relate to in Maine, given the issues with, like, addiction, is that Helen, the character, the customer of the hairdresser, had been a former drug addict.
Oh, yeah.
But she's been clean for a really long time. So the hairdresser says to her, and you know, Helen, you've been clean for so long. You've been clean for 20 years now. But now that you have an art show, you know what's really weird? Now you were in a gallery and you still have a dealer. So...
I love
you know,
it.
Then it brings into question of, you know, the obsession with art and who makes money on it.
That's
without
so
having
great.
To say all that.
I love it. And I love that you can, when you have a fictionalized character, you can invite a conversation without exploiting an individual's actual story and experiences. It's very respectful, too.
I hope so. I mean, that's the goal.
You're coming to Maine soon, and your upcoming performance of this show that you've been demonstrating a piece from is called Off the Record, Between a Laugh and a Hard Place, and it will be performed in Brunswick Thursday the 23rd. Is that right? 23rd? 27th.
No.
Thursday the 27th.
Thursday the 27th.
Thank you. Can you tell us why you're putting this show on in Brunswick and who benefits from it?
Well, this actually came about because of an individual, one person. So if you think that one person can't make a difference, you know, think again, right?
Great example, yeah.
Joanne Rosenthal, who saw me perform.
And she invited you to Maine?
Well, not exactly. I had performed at the Space Gallery a couple of years ago.
Sure, here in Portland.
I did a different show, and she had seen me perform there. And then she asked me if I would do a show last year at, I think, a different church. And I said, sure. And then she asked me if I was coming back to Maine this year. And I said, yes. And she said, well, let's see if we can do a show at this church, the Universalist Unitarian Church in Brunswick. And they are starting an organization about welcoming new immigrants in. And so we decided to do it as a benefit for that organization.
I love that. I love that. I love both of those parts. One, that she's a retired social worker who says she's not working, but she's busy organizing all kinds of benefits and support for new immigrants. Brunswick hasn't had a ton of immigrants, but they're starting to see some. So they've organized a group called Welcoming New Mainers Support Group, an interfaith collaborative offering resettlement support to asylum seekers and refugees in the Bath, Brunswick area. So if people are interested in attending your show on Thursday, the 27th of July at 7:30, it will be at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Brunswick, Maine at 1 Middle Street in Brunswick. And I would direct traffic to Brown Paper Tickets. All the information for the show and the tickets can be found at brownpapertickets.com.
It's probably the easiest way to find it, though, because there's so many shows on Brown Paper Tickets, is just to go to earsay.org and follow the links.
Oh, that's a great idea. Sure. That's your organization.
It's easier website, earsay.org, and then they just follow the links.
Wonderful.
And they can come through the door as well if they know where the church is.
Right. In Brunswick.
Yeah.
Judith, you are not only an accomplished performer, but you are a powerful organizer who values the community we create together. Thank you for sharing your talents with Maine and also for the benefit to support asylum seekers from around the world, people now living as new Mainers. I wish you all the best with Earsay and your future projects, and I hope you keep them coming. Thank you for being my guest today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. And are you going to play that Listen to Me song on the way out?
I am. I would love it if you would kindly...
Let me just set this up for people. I run a program for new immigrant and refugee teenagers and college students who all collaborate and work together. And in the fall of 2016, everybody was standing around trying to think about what we were going to do in response to what seemed like a devastating election, and has played out that way. And they had written, a girl who's Chinese and Malaysian had written this chorus, Listen to Me, and then the group decided to write verses based on what everybody was experiencing afterwards. So it became a song that we started having people sing along, and that's what it came out of. It grew out of that great collaboration.
An organic experience at International High School at LaGuardia Community College, is that right?
Yes, with our Earsay Youth Voices program.
Well, thank you so much for sharing it today. We'll look forward to hearing it, and good luck at your performance.
Thank you. I hope to see people there.
Okay, thanks. Listen to Me, Earsay Youth Voices, coming right up.
Listen to me. I have so many dreams. Listen to me. I have so many dreams. Escucha. Escúchame, tengo muchos sueños. Escucha, escúchame, tengo muchos sueños. I crossed the border by myself, living in the city, got no one else. I'm just a teenager going to school. I ain't a terrorist, a monster, and I ain't your fool.
Ακούσε με, έχω πολλά όνειρα.
Σουνο αμάκε, αμαρανέκ, σαπνο ατσέ.
Τινγω
σω,
βόιο,
αντώε τίν.
Τινγω
σω,
βόιο,
αντώε.
Listen, Buckingham, listen to me. I have so many dreams. Listen, écoute, listen to me. I have so many dreams.
You stirred up hatred and violence, you won on fear. But we ain't gonna cower or disappear. You're living in your tower with your golden chairs, but your money won't save you when the storm is here.
Listen,
shuno amake,
I have
ego por la onira.
Listen,
suhai mie,
I have
oyo hando yeti.
Listen to me.
Wait a minute.